الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر
In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, the Creator and the Sustainer of the Universe, peace and blessings upon His servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Amin. I bear witness that there is no God worthy of worship except the one true God, and I bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger and servant of God. I greet you all with the universal greetings of peace, the greetings that have been used by all the prophets from Abraham to Prophet Muhammad. Peace and blessings be upon them all. Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be unto you. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we have our 11th program in this series on moral teachings of Islam. In today's program, we'll continue with our discussion of dietary laws in Islam. I have with me again on today's program Dr. Jamal Badawi of Sage Marriage University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Now, last week we had a very interesting discussion. We were talking about the prohibition of the eating of pork in Islam, and we discussed some of the chemical as well as some of the medical reasons for the prohibition. Could you perhaps just very quickly highlight the main points that we touched on last week in our program?
Sure. Perhaps you can make reference to the diagrams that we used last time. After talking about the broad classification of different types of fats and oils, we looked at the neutral lipids or fats, and we said it comes in various forms: monoglyceride, diglyceride, triglyceride, and free fatty acids. We focused further on the triglyceride molecule, or you could say the fat molecule, and we said that each fat molecule or triglyceride molecule is composed of glycerol plus three fatty acids. The distribution of those fatty acids make a difference in terms of the exact nature or type of fat molecule. And he said that these fatty acids are either saturated or unsaturated. And based on this basic structure or composition of the fat molecule, we tried also to show the various distribution of fatty acids in the fat molecule. As we said before, U stands for unsaturated fatty acids and S for saturated fatty acids. These are the various forms of this distribution of these three fatty acids in the fat molecule. What was really more important in this whole thing is that many studies showed that if you have a high concentration of saturated fatty acids in position 2, in the structure of the fat molecule, it becomes very difficult to digest. The reason being is that the pancreatic lipase, which comes from the human pancreas to help dissolve or hydrolyze or digest fat, cannot succeed really in breaking down a fat molecule that has saturated fatty acids in that particular position. And the opposite is true when you have unsaturated fatty acids in that position. How does that relate to pork? We have seen again that studies showed that in plant-eating animals, you get, generally speaking, a high concentration of unsaturated fatty acids in position 2, which means it becomes rather easy to digest. On the other hand, experiments on meat-eating animals showed that, generally speaking, they tend to have a high concentration of saturated fatty acids in that position, which make it difficult to digest. Which means also that the fat, in the case of vegetarian animals, is resynthesized in human fat, whereas in other meat-eating animals, it is absorbed as it is, not resynthesized. But the most interesting part of this whole discussion is that experimental animals, in the case of meat that was easy to digest included poultry, beef, sheep, and deer. On the other hand, the animals that showed the high concentration of saturated fatty acids in position 2, the ones that were very difficult to digest, included dogs, cats, rats, and pigs, which shows that pigs really do not belong to the edible animals. It's a meat eating, it's a scavenger.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing we discussed briefly also was the myth that because the fat or the pork fat contains a high percentage of polyunsaturated fats, that it is easier. And we said that's a myth, because even though this is true, it still has saturated fatty acids in position 2, which is the crucial position insofar as digestion. So yes, there is unsaturated fat, but the body doesn't benefit because the fat molecule cannot be broken down or hydrolyzed, as the chemist called it. So the body wouldn't really benefit from it. It's very difficult to digest despite of all of that. And then we shifted to the medical aspect. We were talking about the chickenella, which is a kind of very dangerous round worm which infests the pigs, which unlike other worms, it gets into the stomach, the capsule is opened, the larva is freed, it goes to the human intestines where it matures and mates, and then release a large number of microscopic larvae which get into the bloodstream, out of the blood vessels, into the muscles of the body, which is very difficult to treat and causes lots of kind of ailments.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, I'd like to look at the situation of other edible animals. And people oftentimes make the point that animals like cattle, sheep, and so on,
mm-hmm.
these animals also can transmit disease.
Mm-hmm.
How then, in your opinion, are they different from the pig?
Well, I wouldn't just give an opinion. I'd like to refer to science on this point. But this is just a very simple... The kind of round worm that we're talking about can be composed of two basic species. Both of them start with the name Tenia. But you see, there's a type of round worm called Tenia saginata and another called Tenia solium. Now, the first type of species of round worm, yes, you're right, it could infest also cattle. However, in this kind of species of worms, the complete life cycle of the worm is completed in the GI tract or the gastrointestinal tract. And as such, if there's any damage, the damage would be limited to the GI tract. And it also means something more important. What happens if the life cycle is completed in the intestine? You can take medicines
mm-hmm.
so that it'll be relatively easier to treat.
A localized kind of situation.
Exactly, right. Whereas in the other type, which infests the hog, or the pig, this kind does not complete its life cycle in the gastrointestinal tract. As we were just summarizing now, it goes into the whole body. It does not complete the cycle until it goes to the muscles and then again encapsulates itself in a cyst, in a form of cyst. See the point?
Mm-hmm.
Which means then that the damage is much graver and very difficult to reach in terms of treatment. So yes, if the worms affect other animals, the most dangerous definitely is the one that attacks the or infests the pig.
Mm-hmm. But definitely some indication of how trichinosis develops, but I wonder perhaps you might expand on. I'm sure many viewers would be interested in knowing how trichinosis breaks out.
Well, I got a quotation here from the book I showed last time. It's called Modern Biology, just a brief paragraph, which explains it and also elaborates on this main point I was mentioning earlier about the life cycle. It says there, and I'm just quoting, the trichina worm, or trichinella, is one of the most dangerous of the parasitic round worms. This round worm passes its first stage as a cyst in the muscles of a pig, dog, rat, or cat. if uncooked meat scraps from infested animals are fed to pigs, it is likely that the scraps will contain cysts. In the intestine of a pig that eats uncooked infested meat scraps, the larva develops into adult worms, mate, and produce microscopic larvae that pass into the bloodstream and into the muscles, where they again form cysts. When a human being eats undercooked infested pork, the same thing happens. The cysts are released, and the larva matures in the intestine. Each worm discharged in the bloodstream about 1,500 youngs, which eventually form cysts in the muscles of the human being. This disease is known as the trichinosis. One method of preventing it is to feed hogs only cooked meat scraps. However, the best way to prevent this disease, as well as other parasitic worm infection, is to cook all meats as thoroughly as possible and thereby avoid any risk. In fact, the best way, as one student was telling her teacher, who admired that, just, yeah, exactly, if it's that dangerous, very difficult, why not just avoid it altogether? It's not like avoiding other things that we might have mild risk, but with the drastic danger involved. Well, the best way is just keep. I'm leaving aside even the arguments from the scriptural point of view, either in the Bible, the Quran, or other aspects of the structure of the fat molecule. Each of these reasons alone suffices to keep off.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, an interesting point that I'd like to get you to comment on, I think it's in this article, it talks about cooking and so on, and a lot of people, I'm sure, are saying, well, yes, you're talking about the severity of this kind of disease and so on, but what is the probability, and aren't there ways in which it can be lessened? For example, people mm-hmm. make the point that if pork is properly cooked, mm-hmm. then the probability or the chances of getting or the danger of getting trichinosis is lessened. How true is that in your opinion?
Well, let me quote you here from the book written, I meant referred to before, by Dr. Ahmed Sakhar, who is mm-hmm. again a specialist in the food technology. He quotes the USDA leaflet number 34, in which it says there that in a series of 24 cases of trichinosis reported recently, 22 were said to have resulted from cooked pork. Elsewhere in the book, he mentions also that some people have the myth that, well, if you buy from a classy store and clean outlet, that you don't have that danger. Because, again, he refers to cases where trichinosis has been traced to stores or shops in very classy so-called area, very rich areas, even in places like San Francisco and other places similar to that. So there's no question definitely that thorough cooking in itself, leaving aside the religious aspect, the fat problem involved with the pork, may help, but there's no guarantee, at least as far as even the most modern technology that we have in North America still. Of course, you heard recently in our province here about the breakout of infestation of trichinosis in mm-hmm. East Preston. Mm-hmm. There's no guarantee that this would really totally eliminate the chances of infestation.
I'd like to look now at the ingredients in which pork and its products are used, beginning first of all with meat products. What kinds of caution should be observed about these kinds of products?
Well, I hope you don't mind if I start with the obvious, at least to make it clear, because I realize that some of the viewers might be, for example, Muslims who immigrated relatively recently mm-hmm. to the West, and they should be aware of these terms, some are not totally clear on. But of course, when you buy fresh meat, you avoid anything that has the name on it, like pork, bacon, ham. In buying things from the store, like, for example, salami or hot dogs or pastrami, one has to make sure that it doesn't simply say all meat, because there could be all kind of meat there. But it must be pure beef or 100% beef or all beef type of product. But, of course, pork, ham and bacon should be avoided at all costs. But others, one can make sure that it's 100% beef. Or like some frankfurters or hot dogs are made of turkey, for example. If one makes sure that by reading the ingredients carefully, that it doesn't contain other, pork or lard.
What about other types of cooked meat, for example, things that you might order in a restaurant, for example?
Well, you have to be careful, but it's not an impossible task, really. For example, in many restaurants where they have, for example, steaks, when the steak is just made without any wine on it, some use cooking wine. You just have regular steak, barbecued or whatever, marinated without using wine, like I said. On charcoal, there's no difficulty with that. Just make sure that it's put on a clean grill that doesn't have any lard on it, for example, from previous cooking. But this is usually the case because most of the stores where they have these steaks, it's usually beef steaks, so there's no problem with that. A chicken, cooked chicken, if there's no lard used in cooking or garnishing for that matter, or if it's fried in 100% vegetable oil, there's no problem. Actually, some outlets claim that they always use 100% vegetable oil in frying chicken. French fries, the same thing. If pure vegetable oil is used in cooking, there should not be much really problem with that. If you, for example, order something like breakfast, this is something that you have to watch for. Either you can have poached eggs, boiled eggs. If you really want to have fried eggs, you make sure it's fried in butter or vegetable oil and not really containing any remains or leftover of pork or lard used by other customers. It has to be in a clean, separate dish. So it's not impossible, but it requires a person to not to feel shy, quite frankly, and just to go and politely ask.
But I guess this question of being able to distinguish which food products and which items contain lard is a very major problem, particularly for Muslims in an area, say, like Nova Scotia or other areas where the Muslim community is relatively small and people are not perhaps careful about or don't have the same sensitivities as Muslims would have to the whole situation. I wonder if perhaps you could comment in terms of how some helpful suggestions, perhaps, in terms of how people you can distinguish those foods which contain lard.
Okay, I think the best recommendation really is to carefully read the ingredients before buying anything until you know which brands are safe. But the major problem, Brother Hamid, lies in the nature of shortening, because shortening goes into almost any product. In most products, it's there. One of these things is to read, for example, whether it says, if it says animal fat on the ingredients, then there's a chance that it may contain lard, because animal includes also pig, at least insofar as the classification goes. Unless it says specifically beef fat or beef tallow or marine oils or something like that, then you can make sure it has to be purely like that. If the term used in the ingredients list is shortening, period. Again, shortening could be anything. It could be possibly vegetable oil, animal fat, combination. So one has to make sure that it's not simply say shortening, but either 100% or pure or all vegetable oil. This is one thing in terms of the oils used in cooking. So, like I said, by carefully reading the ingredients, it shouldn't be hard.
What about the question of bread, for example? They have to be careful in terms of the...
Right. I'm glad that you raised that, because some people again say, well, what's the problem with the bread? And they forget also that it is the practice in many bakeries, for example, to brush the loaves with lard or shortening, which may contain lard, or use it even as part of the dough in making the bread. But fortunately, if a person really is sensitive about it and really wants to avoid, there's no difficulty with that. In any place, in any location, almost, you find some places or some brands of bread which are made of pure vegetable oil. In some chain stores, I don't want to make any free commercial to anyone, but in some mini chain stores, they have a policy, for example, that homemade bread is always made with pure vegetable shortening. Some people in many locations in North America hear about the so-called Lebanese or Syrian bread, you know, this round, chewy bread. Usually, it is made without any shortening, so that could be safe also. Diet bread usually doesn't contain. There are some brands even which are relatively cheaper brands in the market, which you could also find in the ingredients that it is all used, it's made with pure vegetable shortening. Of course, in pies and cakes and so on, the same thing would be applicable, especially in the crust. In some cakes, the crust is made with lard. So by being careful and reading carefully before buying, it shouldn't be too hard to find substitutes. No problem.
Okay.
It's hard at the beginning, at least.
Are there any other foods that you can think of which might contain pork ingredients? Like, for example, you know things that it would be obvious now that you check for things which would obviously contain lard in them, but are there any other foods which one may not normally be aware of, may not think of as having pork ingredients in them?
Well, a common thing like that is gelatin. You see, in jello or gelatin, it is made also partly of skin or marrow of animals, which may be pork or it may be other animals. But again, there are certain brands in the market. For example, it was communicated to me that the kind that has K on it in a circle, that means kosher. I heard also, but I haven't been able to confirm that. This is not a very difficult thing to do by writing to the manufacturers. There are some kind of synthetic type of gelatin that doesn't have any animal base in it. Somebody was telling me that it has the letter U on it. But this one, I am less sure than the case where you have K. In addition to that, there are some stores that carry, for example, purely kosher items, which would include, of course, the kosher jello used by the Jewish community, because they have the same kind of belief also concerning the pork. So this gelatin would be one of the things really to watch for.
Well, what about the situation of gelatin in drug capsules?
Well, you're getting into a very fine thing. All right. There are some, you're right, some capsules which have a capsule made of gelatin or partly gelatin, which again could be gelatin derived from pork or others. But I have my own tips for that. I used to take, for example, vitamin A. But it's not difficult. These capsules can be opened. So what I do, I just bring a glass, open the capsule, take the powder, just put some orange juice or something on it, and drink it. So if a person really is particular about it, and I really appreciate you raising this, because it is a real problem for someone really who wants to keep pure from any pork contents.
Well, now, what about the situation of insulin, for example? Isn't this an area where you might possibly have maybe pork used in the insulin?
Well, some claim that it's used from extracts, I believe, from the pancreas of the pig, but it's also used alternatively from other edible animals. So one can check, for example, with the pharmacist and find out what ingredients were used in manufacturing. So there's always a substitute if one really cares. You can avoid that. But of course, if you run into a situation when the only insulin available is extracted from pork or something like that, then there is a provision in Islam for that, because that constitutes saving life. But before one jumps to that, one has to find out first if there is a wholesome substitute at all.
I also understand that there may be some difficulty with cheese. So there's some viewpoint that cheese might present some kind of a problem.
You see, the difficulty arising with the cheese is that, in addition to the bacterial culture used for making cheese, some manufacturers use a little bit of pepsin, which acts more as a catalyst to help in the process of, you know, cheese making. Now, it is said that the pepsin also may be derived, or usually is derived, in fact, from, pork contents, or probably from lard. This is an area which led some Muslim jurists when the things were explained to them, to come up with this explanation. They said, first of all, the information given to them is that it is only a chemical thing. It's not lard in its original form. It's just a chemical type of product. Number two, that it is used in a very, very minute amount, and according to one who was saying that the information he received is that you use something like an ounce per 10,000 pounds of cheese.
Mm-hmm.
That this chemical is used only as a catalyst, and part of it, if not most of it actually, does not really come into the cheese itself. So on the basis of that, there is more than one Muslim jurist who... there are other additional reasons, although I don't want to go into all details on this, that they, for this very minute thing, and only as a catalyst, and as a chemical compound rather than pure original form of lard, that it would be permissible. However, I feel that if a person can find a substitute, I don't think there's much excuse. If you feel that this area is doubtful and some jurists dispute whether it's permissible or not, it's better a way to find a substitute. An example of this, right in our area here, I could easily find, for example, cheddar cheese made simply of bacterial culture but not using pepsin in it.
Mm-hmm.
There are other kinds of cheese which uses rennet, and I checked with my wife, she is also a master's in education specializing in nutrition. And she said her understanding also that rennet is used from edible animals, not from pork, for other edible animals. So if one makes sure of that, the feta cheese, for example, that comes usually from Denmark, and sometimes is made also in other Middle Eastern countries, it's white mm-hmm. cheese. This is usually safe also because it uses rennet. So even though there is a ground from some jurist verdict on cheese for this variety of reasons given, it's better actually to get a substitute if possible at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there's leeway in that.
Well, the final question I think we have time for today is looking at other kinds of meat-eating animals other than the ones that we've discussed at this point. Are there other meat-eating animals that one should be careful about?
Yes. In fact, according to the saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in both Bukhari and Muslim, the most authentic sources of hadith, he said that animals, just to translate it in a simple way, birds or animals that are meat-eating are also forbidden to Muslims. Things like hawks, for example, mm-hmm. and similar crows, as well as meat-eating animals like lions, tigers, and so on, which is very consistent with the previous discussion that we had on the difference between meat-eating and vegetarian animals.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll conclude our program at that for today. We want to thank you for watching. We want to invite you back next week when we'll look at the question of intoxicants. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. Allahu Akbar.